You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the fabulous Feinsteins, 54 Below. Before we get started this evening, just a polite reminder. Please take this moment to silence your cell phones. Also, there is no flash photography, please.
Welcome to the Feinsteins 54 Below podcast. I'm Nella Vera, the club's marketing director. This week, we have an extra special episode with a fantastic guest host. Today's episode will be hosted by Alan Seals, who, along with being one of the founders of the Broadway Podcast Network, is also the host of the very popular theater podcast. Welcome, Alan.
Hey, Nella. It's nice to be here.
So great to have you. Alan, by the way, is also one of the producers of Is This a Room and Dana H, playing in rep on Broadway at the Lyceum Theater. And I just want to pause for a moment and say congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Amazing pieces of theater. I saw them both. And I want to encourage all our listeners to get their tickets. I don't know if I've ever seen anything like that on Broadway before. So for everybody who's wondering what they're about, get ready for something really special with each one of them.
They're amazing, true stories. You cannot miss this. It's such new theater, and it's very exciting to have them both playing in rep.
I love the idea of documentary theater like that being on Broadway, like real life dramatized on stage.
Yeah. When you think about like a transcript of an interrogation, you don't think Broadway play, but the way that it's executed and delivered is just brilliant and beautiful. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
Let's talk about our special guest.
Yeah. Alan is here today because we are partnering with the Theater Podcast to release this week's episode. We have a really epic and exciting guest, and one podcast just wasn't going to be enough. So we decided to team up for this interview. And also, Alan, I hope this is going to be one of many future collaborations between our two podcasts.
I hope so, too. It's such a great idea.
And now I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to let you take over.
All right, here we go.
Today's guest is a Tony Award-nominated actress, maybe best known for her portrayal of Galinda in Wicked. Other Broadway credits include Doralee Rhodes in Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, the musical, and Brooke Ashton in Noises Off. She became a worldwide triple threat known as Ivy Lynn on NBC's musical drama Smash. Other television credits include recurring roles on Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, The Good Wife, Braindead, and Louie, among many others, and she can be seen performing across the globe to sold-out houses, including concerts with the New York Pops at Carnegie Hall, I'm running out of breath, and the National Symphony Orchestra at the Kennedy Center and the New York Philharmonic at Lincoln Center. She's recorded 3 albums of her own and is now making her 54 Below debut. Woo-hoo! With a 6-show series running from November 2nd to 7th. Megan Hilty, welcome to this very special crossover episode between the Theater Podcast and the Feinsteins 54 Below podcast.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I kept my breath after all that.
That was quite the intro. Wow.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you for doing so much for all of us to talk about.
No problem.
So 54 Below, you're coming. It's coming up this concert. Everybody go get tickets to 54 Below, to your show 54 Below. You can go to your Instagram, get tickets, go to 54 Below, get tickets. But this is actually your 54 Below debut.
Yes. Yeah.
So there have been many years of you, many years of 54 Below. Why just now is this coming to be?
You know, it's only now just worked out to be a possibility because with concert, Concert contracts are a little different in that you kind of have to sign off on not performing within like a 90 mile radius of whatever theater you're performing in for at least like a couple months before and after.
So really?
So that the ticket sales aren't competing for the same market. And it makes sense. You know, at first it's like, oh, that, you know, that's weird. But when you think about it, it actually makes sense. You don't want to split your audience between two places. So, you know, it just hasn't worked out until right at this moment for this incredible thing that they're doing with the Diamond Series.
Yes.
Yeah, it's more like an experience than just a concert. It's a four-course dinner. You know, it's not your typical 54 Below show where there's multiple shows in a night. Like, you come, you spend some good time eating this amazing dinner, and then you get that one show of the evening for whatever artist you're there to see. I'm hoping you'll come and see mine, but like Kelly's already done hers.
Kelly O'Hara, Benanti,
yeah. Laura Benanti, is well into her amazing run there. And then Jennifer Holliday is going to be, performing it, I believe, in January.
Can we talk about her Tony performance for a second?
Oh my God. Yeah. She's amazing. She's an icon.
I heard, and you're friends with her. Yeah. And maybe, you know,
I don't know her. I don't know her. I'm just a fan. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I just assumed that like all Broadway divas, of which you are part of in my mind, I'll just have this secret Broadway diva club, right? Where you hang out.
I've got my club of Broadway divas, but you know, unfortunately I haven't had the honor and pleasure to befriend Miss Holliday.
Well, yeah. That's it. Jennifer is an avid listener of this podcast. Yay! I'm sure. So Jennifer, reach out to Megan. You guys need to be friends.
Hopefully. Yeah.
So tell me about the story though, because when you're crafting the story of the show, right? Because 54 Below, it's like traditionally cabaret sort of, mm-hmm. Concerts, and everything I've ever seen there has been a story about that person. Right. Mm-hmm. It's which is basically sort of what I guess what cabarets are, right? It's a showcase what you can do, showcase who you are. And so was this sort of an easy thing for you to put together when you're putting together the show? Because you've got a big swath of content and interests and credits. And so how do you condense it all into one performance?
Well, years and years ago, I did not want to do the cabaret scene. I did the idea of like a one person show just made me so nervous, because I was like, I don't have like a story to tell. I don't have like a beginning, middle, and end and something to leave people with. But it wasn't until it became clear that it's not about that. The whole point of doing these concerts is to see an artist as themselves and not the characters that they play. And so once I discovered that that's what it's really about, it became so much easier to approach putting together a set list. And really what's most important is picking these songs that are important in some way to you as the performer. The songs come first, and then the arranging of them to make sure that the energy is flowing correctly throughout the show. You don't have too many ballads together. You don't have too many of the same type of things together, so that, you know, you want to keep people interested and kind of go on this almost like roller coaster of an energy journey. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yes.
That has natural ebbs and flows and I'd like to think that over the years, I think I've been doing this for like 10 years now. I have a general sense of what's going to work and what things need to be what things need to be in certain places to make sure that I don't lose everybody.
That's really cool. I mean, it's more or less like workshopping a Broadway show, right? You want to make sure that the story flows and that the songs are in the right order and whatnot, and adding and cutting. So do you do this? Did you put this all together on your own? Or like when you're looking back at your life, I'm thinking from a personal lens, right? If someone were to say, Alan, you've got like 2 weeks to put together a cabaret show for something, you know, Duplex, 54 Below, Green Room 42, whatever the case is, I don't even know where or even how I would start. So where do you begin with, I mean, do you start at the beginning? Like, I'm born and this is a song that represents me.
So like I said, I started doing these types of shows about 10 years ago, and I just learn from each and every show. It's not like this is the first one that I've ever done and I have to start from scratch. Luckily, I've had, you know, years and years to kind of hone this. And just as these shows are supposed to show you who we are as people, aside from our characters, we're constantly changing. And like, I'm constantly doing different projects, which add different repertoire to. So like these concerts at 54 Below, these will be the first ones that have stuff from the film that I did with Jesse Mueller, Patsy and Loretta. So, you know, and we've kind of taken those and morphed them into our own arrangements to fit our band, to fit the setting, to fit the context of the show. So it's not like we had to go and start from scratch. There's a lot of stuff that's already there. What it comes down to is understanding who our audience is. You know, we have a very theater savvy New York crowd, and that's a very specific thing. And that's different from other cities that we might play, you know, that might come in not knowing who I am at all, you know? So that's something to consider too. There's a lot of things to take into consideration. And luckily, I'm coming back to New York, you know, where I feel like for this series in particular, you're going to buy the ticket because you know the person, you know? I don't feel like there's going to be a lot of people that I'm really introducing myself to so that makes it a very unique set of circumstances, which allows me to pull songs that wouldn't necessarily work anywhere else.
Is that some sort of like inner struggle or inner, I guess a dichotomy of sorts in that you are counting on the fact that people know who you are in this area, but at the same time, there's a little bit of gosh, it's all on me, because you said originally that you were nervous to start doing these one person shows. So now are you at a point where you're like, I have a reputation, I'm okay, I'm doing all right in this New York savvy, theater savvy crowd? Or is there still part of you that's like, are people going to want to come see me?
Oh, there's always that. It doesn't matter. Yeah, there's always that. But what I always come back to, like, I'm always nervous for everything, which I think is a good thing, because it keeps me on my toes. I'm always trying to do better. You know, I'm not phoning anything in. And honestly, during the run of this show, if something is not working, I will switch it with something else. Like that's the luxury with these longer runs, is that like I can really feel, you know, not that I don't think that anything's going to fall totally flat, but if it doesn't feel perfect, we have so much stuff in our repertoire that we can change the run for the next night. Or my band is so amazing that I can call an audible during the show and they'll go with me and we'll just do something that wasn't planned.
Wow.
You know, but they're right there with me and they know all of these songs so well. We've been doing a lot of them for a really long time, and everybody's just so in sync with each other that that we're able to do that. That's kind of how I've constructed these shows. You know, my band is made up of my husband and and three of our best friends. You know, we want you to feel like you have stumbled into our living room and we're all having a really great time together. I just happen to be wearing a really fabulous gown, you know, on top of it. I forget where I was going with this, but all that to say, yes, I'm always nervous for many reasons, but the great thing is I have surrounded myself with the best people on stage. And what it comes down to is us just having a really awesome time together. And we hope that reaches, you know, everybody in the room. Like I said, we want it to feel like you're in our living room.
So talk to me about where you started as a little kid and how you got into theater, because we're going to get to the iconic, never dying family of Wicked. This show is going to run forever.
Forever.
Right? We're going to get there. But before that, you had to start somewhere. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Seattle. Well, just outside of Seattle in Bellevue, Washington. And I grew up always singing, like always. And my mom got me into voice lessons at an early age. And my voice teacher said, you have a voice for classical music. And so she started putting me in all of these classical competitions. And I went to an apprenticeship program with the San Francisco Opera. I really thought that I was going to be an opera singer. But at that apprenticeship program, I discovered that we wouldn't really work until our mid-30s, because that's when a female voice matures. And telling a 16-year-old that is like, that felt like forever away. That felt like I'm never going to be 35, you know? And so I went down the musical theater route, but I was always doing community theater. I was part of a Gilbert and Sullivan theater troupe. And I did, during the summers, I did a youth theater that took up the whole summer, where we built the stages, we made our costumes, you know, and performed for the whole school district at the beginning of the school year, right at the end of summer. So it was always, I was always a part of theatrical productions and singing, always.
What is it about the culture? Is it culture? Was it chosen family? I say, what is it about the culture? But was it that drew you into theater? Because, like, what is it for you that brings you back to the stage every time? Because I know that there are so many stage Broadway performers that, like, go TV and film, and then you do tons of cartoon voices and voiceover work and whatnot. But I find that, and correct me if I'm wrong for you specifically, but people always want to come back to the stage. They always want to come back to theater.
Sure.
Because there's something about that live moment.
Well, yeah, it's a very primal human connection. That's it. Like, that's it. It's the theater is the only type of arts where there is an exchange of energy, you know, so that will never die, because we always need people. We always need that connection, you know? So yeah, it's completely understandable that everybody always wants to flock back to the theater, whether you're doing a concert or, you know, a play or a musical or an opera, what have you, anything. We always, always, always need that human connection.
Is that what, sort of looking back at your life as a young child, was it that sort of thing that drew you to it as a kid? Or did you not realize that until, like, later on in life?
I don't know. To be quite honest, I think it filled certain needs that just children in general have, like feeling like you belong to something. I think that's really important for young people, to feel like you're connected and you belong to some kind of group. And for me, it was my theater pals, most of whom I didn't go to school with. Mm-hmm. I also, like I said, I was always singing. So having an actual outlet for that was necessary. And it was kind of addicting, you know, and I mean, to be super duper honest too, you know, I got a lot of attention when I was on stage, you know, I never got that like in life. So as a young person in particular, that was really important to me as well. You know, getting attention, getting to use my voice and feeling like I belonged somewhere, you know, it checked all of those super important boxes. Yeah.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have two younger sisters. They're twins and they're gorgeous. They're like 5 inches taller than me. They have really dark hair and they tan, and like, they're like just, and they're funny and like smart and stuff. So like, everybody loves them. So that was another thing, is that my family all liked to joke that was the only reason why I became a performer, because it was the only way that I could get any kind of attention, because my sisters got it everywhere else. Yeah.
Well, that's why I asked that, because you say as a kid you didn't get attention, but as the oldest child, like, I was the oldest child too. And I was always demanding, like, look at me.
Yeah.
I am the oldest.
Yeah. I think I just required extra attention. Yeah. Say what you will about what that means about me, but
some people, no, I get it. Some people are like that. And no matter, gosh, it's no matter how many accolades you get and how successful you are. I always like the quote that Andre DeShields gave in his Tony acceptance speech a couple of years ago, where he said the top of one mountain is the bottom of the next.
Yeah.
That puts perfectly into words how so many of us operate. It's just like, we're there's something in the back of our heads. Like, we're just not good enough. We're just not there. We're just not able to fulfill whatever ache that is.
Yeah.
And then we get where, and we think that, you know, we're continuing on, and we get there and like, okay, so I'm here. Cool. Now I guess I'll just keep on going.
Yeah. Well, there is no end point. There is no like point of success. Like there, it's all ebbs and flows. It's going to come and it's going to go, and you're going to be busy and you're going to be like, you know, dying for work. You know, it's a constant, ever-changing battle.
Well, how did you then, taking it back to you then, how did you, do you sort of branch out and do so much? Because it feels like all of these things you're doing could be one career on their own, right? So you've got the musical theater, you've got TV and film, and you've got voiceover work, and you've got the independent, the concert traveling and touring, and being a mom, that's a hard enough job in and of itself. I mean, I know how you got to be a mom. That's pretty simple biology. But the whole, all of the other roles that you're doing, why did you keep adding? And not saying that as a bad thing. I'm curious to explore this as to say, why continue to grow when all of these require so much time on their own?
Right. Well, a long time ago, actually, when I came out to LA with Wicked, which was a long time ago, I want to say like, is it 12 years ago? 13 years ago? It was a long time ago.
Sure, we'll go with that.
But I came out to establish the sit-down company of Wicked out in Los Angeles. And that's when my horizon started to broaden a little bit, because for a long time, once I decided musical theater was it, I was like, oh, that's it. Like, I don't want to do television, movies, like all that. You know, I was real like, I don't know what I had against everything else, but once I came out here, a lot of other opportunities started to present themselves, especially being in that platform of being in Wicked in Los Angeles. I started to really like question where I wanted my career to go at that point. And in doing that, I was like, well, whose career do I want to emulate? And the person who came up immediately was Bernadette Peters. And now before I go any further, I want to clarify that the goal was not to be Bernadette Peters, because nobody can be Bernadette Peters. She is a singular talent, and nobody, and I think it is foolish for anybody to try to be another person. That is not what I'm saying. What I wanted to emulate was the many different branches her career, you know, the tree of her career had, you know, because she did it all. She did movies, television, voiceover, concerts, Broadway, and dominated all of them, you know, and might I add, an amazing person on top of dominating everything, you know, like everybody wants to work with her because she's a phenomenal person on top of her talent. Anyway, so I started thinking, oh, maybe the key to longevity in this business is to diversify and to have all those branches, you know? And it was always a dream of mine to be in voiceover and animation. I, you know, like so many people, I wanted to be a Disney princess growing up. I didn't want to like put on the gowns. I wanted to do the voices. I wanted to sing the songs. I didn't want to look like them. I just wanted to like, I specifically wanted to voice them. And so I started, I started going down that route. Yeah, that was like 14 years ago that I got my voiceover agent out in Los Angeles and started really, because that is a very different career.
Absolutely.
Very different. It's just a whole different, it's a different talent. It's a different business sense, like every sense. And I love it. It is probably my absolute favorite thing to do ever. And luckily I started pounding the pavement 14 years ago and just chipped away and chipped away and paid my dues and paid my dues and have built this thing that I'm super proud of in the animation world. But the same thing with, and all of these things just kind of terrified me, you know, TV, film, concerts, all of these things, they just sounded like, you know, they're so different, you know, but at the same time, what I started learning really quickly is that, by doing these other things, these other mediums, it actually makes me better in the other things, if that makes sense. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's by opening my world up, you know, to those different types of mediums, it just fed like the TV stuff fed the theater thing in a host of different, you know, ways that, I mean, we could talk all day about that. But yeah, it became a long time ago, apparently like 14 years ago, it became very important to me to diversify so that I could actually have a long career in this business.
I'm glad that you said the thing about the TV kind of crossing over, because I wanted to ask about Smash next, because it's been a hot minute since that was out. And that propelled the fortunate and unfortunate part of the Broadway world is that it's really, really hard to get like super famous and super, and therefore some would say super successful, in just Broadway stage. So then you add TV and film to that, and that boosts people to a whole different level, right? Mm. So you've taken the Broadway, the singing, the performing, and put it on TV, which has taken you as your career. Like you said, one helps the other. So now on an international level, people see you on TV doing what you used to do just for in-person Broadway audiences, and it's pushed everything into a whole new realm.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
looking back on that though, like, I don't know the order of operations of your TV career. So what, were you already sort of, were you already deep into the TV and film world before Smash came along, or did that propel, the TV and film afterwards, after
Smash? No. I was trying to like knock down the door to the television world. And before Smash, I had done some like small roles, some recurring roles and stuff like that. So the TV world was not like this totally, you know, unknown thing when I got Smash. But it was a very, very, I didn't just like fall into it. It was a very like, not calculated, but like I left New York after 9 to 5 closed. I mean, if we're going to get real about this, I was really brokenhearted about how 9 to 5 closed. That was one of the biggest heartbreaks of my life, was getting our closing notice for 9 to 5. It didn't make any sense to any of us, playing to all of these like sold out houses that were screaming on their feet, singing with us and dancing at the end of every show to get our close. It made zero sense. And I was really, I had come back to New York from LA, where I was doing Wicked. And we did the out of town tryouts for 9 to 5 in Los Angeles as well. And so when we got our closing notice, I decided, because I was so sad and angry, to be really honest, I was like, I can't stay here. I can't stay in New York. I need to, like, people will smell the anger and the hurt. You know, I'm not going to get a job here. I think this is the time to go back to LA and start pounding the pavement and really trying to break into the TV and film world. Because also by that point, I had done many readings and workshops and helped like develop these shows for people, where at the end they're like, we love you, nobody could do this better, but we have to cast somebody from television or like a pop star or a movie mm-hmm. star. You understand, right? You know, because we have to sell tickets. And so finally, after that had happened a handful of times, at the end of 9 to 5, I was like, fine, if that's what you're going to hire, I'm going to go be that. I'm going to go do that. I'm going to get some TV credits so that I can actually like work in these shows that I'm helping to develop, you know, like, so I, you know, it was kind of a, it was a, multiple reasons. I was upset. I couldn't stay in New York. And I knew that, in order to get the roles that I wanted to, I had to diversify and I had to really, really spend the time focusing on the television end of it. So I did, and I came back to LA and I started doing those small roles and gaining people's trust and learning about how to work on camera. And then Smash came along, you know, and kind of, and we all know how that ended up.
did you get asked to audition for Smash based on your contacts in LA or New York? Because I'll let you answer first.
No, let's be super clear. Nobody asked me to audition. it was during pilot season.
No kidding.
What was very helpful is that the person who produced 9 to 5, Bob Greenblatt, Smash was his project and he had just taken over at NBC. So he was aware of who I was because we'd worked together for years, but nobody asked me to audition for it. It was one of those, like, my agents and manager at the time got me an appointment for it. And I went into the Los Angeles associate casting director and put myself on tape like everybody else. I did all the scenes, I did the songs, and So there was no there was no like, will you come in and read for this? No.
I would have just figured that there would have been a short list of people who are amazing on stage that are going to translate well to camera. And you were on that short list and then it was just an easy choice, right?
It's a brutal business and it rarely, rarely happens like that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. There's so much rejection and so much struggle. Like you said, you pounded the pavement, and I think it takes a lot of strength, a lot of chutzpah to be able to say, you know what? I'm freaking angry with this city here. I'm going to go to a different one. Mm-hmm. And be able to bounce back and forth between the two when needed, because I've been so angry with New York sometimes and I just hibernate. I sit in my office here and I'm like, well, I'm just going to wait to feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. And that works. It works too. At that point in my life, I was like, I need to go, I need to switch gears. I need to focus on this. You know, this door has closed. So I need to like burst open some other doors in LA. And the other part of that was I had already lived in Los Angeles for years at that point. And I'm happy here. I'm happy with the sunshine and the space. And, you know, at that time I was going for hikes all the time. I don't anymore. I liked being here. And when it really came down to it, I was like, I'm not happy in New York. I am happy in the sunshine. I need to go focus on these other things in the sunshine and get myself together so that I can, you know, when I come back to New York, it's in a better headspace than how I left it.
Well, then fast forward a little bit to I guess now, and the Wicked fandom, the Wicked family. You said you helped originate the first sit down cast out in L.A.
No, that was for 9 to 5, not for Wicked.
Oh, sorry. So Wicked, yeah, but okay. So you're part of this Wicked legacy. It really is becoming this legacy of amazing individuals that once you become an Elphaba or a Glinda, or even to some extent the Nessa Rose and a Bach and a Fiera, these main roles, that the show itself gets so much attention constantly, even after 20 years, right? They just had
I came in 9 months after it opened. And I did the first Wicked day, where they shut down, you know, the Gershwin like alleyway and 51st Street. And they did. Yeah.
So this whole show, though, has changed so many lives and influenced so many people and inspired so many individuals to follow the same path. At the time, I guess looking back on it now, you have a lot of perspective, but at the time, were you able to sort of understand the level of importance you were playing in the legacy of the show?
Well, I mean, there was no way to understand, like, how it would affect, like, the future. Like, I had just come out of college and I was terrified. I was legit terrified. I came in right as Kristen Chenoweth and Laura Bell Bundy were leaving, and me and Jennifer Laura Thompson were coming in. So Jennifer Laura Thompson took over for Kristen and I stood by for her. Mm-hmm. And I was a baby. I was a baby. It was my first thing. Like, I just graduated, and it was not lost on me how huge that show was. I was reminded every day when we went out the stage door. And luckily, I just thank my lucky stars every day that social media wasn't the way it was back then. Cause I don't know if my mental emotional state could have really, like, handled that. I can barely handle it now. But with Wicked, there's so much, like, brutal comparisons and, like, oh, everybody's got their opinions that just must be aired. that I don't think I could have handled that, you know. I couldn't,
That's something that I think is worth talking, or at least acknowledging right here, is that the people that are being talked about read this stuff and are also real people and feel things.
We're, you know, humans. And it's not like we're phoning this stuff in. We're giving it everything we have. And for people to just, like, brutally tear it apart for what? Like, it just seems so unfair.
I was at the reopening of Moulin Rouge the other day.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Karen Olivo's not there anymore. Natalie Mendoza's there. And immediately the first thing these two people behind me started talking about as soon as intermission came was this like debate over who they thought was better. It was Natalie or Karen.
I think it's crazy to me. It is crazy to me how people dehumanize us like that. It's really crazy to me. And really feel a sense of entitlement and ownership over us. This stage door stuff has gotten, like, crazy out of control, like crazy out of control. Like, the amount of like verbal abuse that I have suffered because people thought they were giving me a compliment after I've just, like, sweated and given all, like, everything I had for hours on a stage, you know, and people think they're giving you a compliment and think that they have the right to talk about your body and all of these things. Like, it is beyond me, the sense of, like, dehumanization it's just crazy to me. And that is so horrendous to hear people doing that in a theater, in the middle of someone's performance, that they're just, that's really, it's too bad.
Yeah. I did almost say something but I didn't want to get into it.
To what end? What's that going to do? You know?
But it's like, it's literally her opening night, her first time on Broadway in forever.
Yeah.
And everyone's a different person. Right. And I acknowledge the privilege that I have as a cis white man and not having to deal with a lot of the objectification that people are put under, especially women and women of color and whatnot. And yeah, my mental state, now that you mentioned that, just people come out and they would say, like, oh, I didn't expect this to be as bad as it was, or I liked you just as much as Idina, right? Like, those types of things, they are backhanded compliments.
Oh yeah, and they are harmful. Words are very powerful and they are harmful, and it's hard to develop a thick enough skin to let that stuff bounce off, you know, and not stick with you.
What do you do? How do you recharge?
Well, let's see. It's been a long time since I've done the stage door thing. And unfortunately, it was during Noises Off where I wasn't wearing, my costume was very revealing, to put it mildly. And so people really thought that they had the right to speak about my body to me, like at the stage door. And that was so, it was so harmful. You know, even when you think you're saying something nice, really say those words to yourself and really, really think about how that could be received before you actually say them to another human being. It's like, it's, yeah, that one was particularly harsh. And that was a long time ago. I don't know what the future of stage doors are after COVID. Not that we're done with COVID, but like going forward, I don't understand what, if I were a producer, I wouldn't let any of the actors in my show come into contact with strangers, you know, like hordes of strangers, and have them speaking in your face, you know, like, I don't know what the future of the stage dooring looks like, just on a health perspective. That was the other thing. There was a while where like I was trying to take care of my health, you know, so I would always go out of the stage door with my own Sharpie. And someone was like, oh, well, why would you do that? And I was like, oh, just so that we don't pass germs around. They were like, that is so rude. That is so rude that you think that you're going to get germs from me. You know, it was like, what? First of all, that's science. That's science. Second of all, I have to stay healthy to keep doing these shows. And if I don't do these shows, you're going to go online and say I'm a terrible person and that I don't respect my job. Like, it is a no-win situation, you know? This has turned into be kind at the stage door, you know, type of thing. It's really too bad.
it's hard. People think that doing 8 shows a week is something anyone can do. Mm-hmm. And it is far from, that's so far from the
it's
truth.
The hardest
this
spot.
Is,
yeah.
This is the, like, look at something like Moulin Rouge, that has an 8-minute sprint as an opening number. And then you're doing these 180 degree kicks and splits and dancing. And like the whole damn show it's this 2.5-hour marathon that you're doing 8 times a week. And then you've got, you know, the Wickeds and all these other shows that demand so much of the performers. And everyone, especially if you haven't seen a show before or you've been obsessed with a cast album and then you're coming to see the show for the first time, you want it exactly like that cast album. And then the cast in the recording booth, you can do multiple takes, you can tweak it, you can do all sorts of things to make it sound perfect. And then, like you said, if you don't sound exactly perfect 8 times a week, you're going to get dragged across the coals.
Yeah, I would love, it would just be such a dream if audiences were just, and I'm reminded of this when I see things too. Like even if like I find little errors, not errors or things that I think could be fixed or something, then I'm like, oh, wait a second. Look at all of this stuff that we got, you know, like, yeah, maybe that might be better if something, this little thing was changed, but like, on the whole, aren't we so lucky to be sitting here? Those two people sitting behind you were so lucky to be sitting there. All mm-hmm. they should have been talking about is how wonderful it was to be back in a theater again. But no, it was all about comparing these two actresses that, yeah, they're going to play the role differently. Who's better? I mean, come on.
They're different. Everybody's different.
Everybody's different. Yeah.
And the biggest advice that I take away, the biggest, like, thing that sits with me after 180 something interviews I've done in the podcast here is that the more successful you are is a result of how much you embrace what makes you unique. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to emulate somebody else in a role, like when you step in as an understudy or a replacement or whatnot, you're gonna hurt yourself. You're not gonna be authentic. You're not gonna give your best performance, period.
Yeah.
And you're not going to please everyone anyway, because there might be two people that were sitting behind them who disagreed with everything they said. And to this point, there was a whole family of tourists next to me. I say tourist, I assume they were because they were not speaking English. That's my assumption, which is could be wrong. But they, gosh, it, near the end, and I forget what, I think it's Come What May, actually. Aaron Tveit's out there just pouring his guts out on stage, and they are bawling, just like sobbing. Mm-hmm. I have not heard anybody cry like that in years. They were mm-hmm. sobbing at this stuff. Mm-hmm. So they're having the experience literally 5 feet away from the people behind me who are having it's a moderately enjoyable experience. But I guess, you know, to this point, right, like take the criticism privately and don't have it in the middle of the show in intermission, because the people next to me are having the time of their lives.
Yeah, and don't ruin that for them. And the, I mean, the other thing too, I mean, art is subjective, you know, like, of course, everybody's entitled to their opinions, but like, of course. And of course, some performers are going to, you know, connect with you better. You're going to have a better connection with them than others. But like, man, can we start to like focus on the good stuff? Like, can we please? Yeah. Like,
well, I have a silly question for you, speaking of good stuff. So given where you are now and everything you've done, do you still have pinch me moments? Who's like the greatest person you've been like, holy shit, I'm working with Stephen Schwartz coming straight out of college?
I have pinch me moments all the time. One of them is coming up this weekend. So lately I've been doing a bunch of shows with Brian Stokes Mitchell, who is like, I mean, one of the greatest voices of all time. And I get to sing with him, you know, like as a job, you know? I have that. This 54 Below series of shows is a huge pinch me moment because I haven't played with my band for almost 2 years.
Right.
So here's a couple things that make this series very special. November 2nd will be the first time our whole band is back together. It's going to be a very emotional moment for all of us and very joyous. So to witness that is going to be, I would think, something special, because it's going to be special for us. You know what I mean?
Right.
And we're all going to be really excited and really happy. It's also me and my husband's anniversary. It's our anniversary. It's our birthday.
We have the same birthday? That's so cool.
No, we don't have the same birthday. But it's our anniversary. So, and it's going to be the first time that we've left the house together in almost 2 years. do you know what I mean? Like, and gone yes. out of the city and state. And so it's going to be a really, like, that's going to be a real pinch me moment. You know, before everything shut down, I was grateful for these concerts to get to connect with our best friends, with my husband, and make the music that we want to perform. The only reason we're doing these songs is because we love them. You know, nobody's making us do any of this stuff. So it's truly like a joyous occasion. And this one in particular is going to be huge for us. Because I was grateful before, now it's going to be a whole different thing, you know, because we've gone a couple years without. And once you go without, especially something you love so much, you know, the appreciation just deepens.
That's perspective. You don't know you're hot unless you've been cold. You don't know you've been in unless you've been out. I mean,
absolutely.
At the very basic level, it gives you perspective. And just being back in the theaters, I've seen almost every show possible that, you know, when the opportunities presented itself in the last three to four weeks, just because I can. And I don't know now, tomorrow, Delta variant could just explode and it could be shut down again for another who knows how long. So yes. I don't take any of this for granted. And the fact that this is a community, a chosen family that love each other and respect each other and want to see each other succeed. And I missed it so much for the last 18 months. And really one of the few things that kept me going was these types of conversations that we're having right now with the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some people are like, there's no Broadway. Can you continue doing your podcast? And I said, I have to continue.
You have to. Connection. The whole thing is about connection anyway. And at least we had this, right?
Yes. Yeah, so at least being able to virtually see each other and smile, mm-hmm. and you know, I imagine that there's hugs and love and everything going around, but to not be able to actually touch it is, as me as an extrovert, it was actually really, really hard. Yeah. And you know, I still had a group of a pod here that I was with, group of people that I was close to, but it's just not the same. I love like that experience, that feeling of meeting new people and being in a room of energy that is all focused in one direction and heading together on the same journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep.
So of course, just to reiterate, November 2nd through 7th at 54 Below, get tickets to see Megan Hilty's show. We're going to wrap up here with the three closing questions I ask everybody on my podcast.
Oh boy.
Oh, they're easy. The first one, just very simply, is what motivates you?
Oh, what motivates me? I don't know. Like, this is probably not the answer you're looking for. I feel like there is this like freight train inside of me that is just determined to go where it's going to go. And, you know, I don't know that like there are any outside motivations. There's just something inside of me that's like, no, you have to keep going and you have to go after that.
I love that. I love that. There's no wrong answer. So that works. That works. Okay. So the next question is, what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path?
Take it easy on yourself. I look back on specifically like when I see old pictures of me, you know, and I think of how hard I was on myself, you know, for how I looked, how I acted. I wasn't this, I wasn't that. I focused on all the things that I wasn't, you know, instead of really like sitting with and being content with what I was, you know, and I focused so much on what I thought other people wanted me to be, that I could never truly be myself. And it took a really long time. And to be honest, it's still a struggle to know that I am enough. Where I am right now, I am enough. And what I bring to the table is worth something. I wish I could say that to my younger self and that my younger self would hear it. I don't know if I said that to my younger self, if I would fully hear it. But that's the conversation I would have with her.
I have to say that to my present self and yes. I still don't hear it.
Yeah. I hear it more now. I hear it more. And the older I get it, I don't know if easier is the best way, but way to put it, but I understand it more now. I wish I could sit here and say like, that's what I practice and I am enough. But it is a practice. It's something that's active that you're actively working on. But yeah, I wish my younger self could have known a little bit of that.
I like that. All right. So the last question, hardest one, if you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Sweeney Todd.
And we're back.
Sweeney Todd. I mean, this is the easiest one. What are you talking about? Like this is, this is the easiest question.
Yeah, before I even finished reading the question, you were nodding. You're like, yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's Sweeney Todd.
Oh, I love that. Okay. Where can we find you online on social media?
Oh, I'm on Twitter and Instagram. It's Megan Hilty. I got that little blue check.
Little blue check.
It's me.
You can get more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com. You can get more of the 54 Below podcast at bpn.fm/54below. Find me on Instagram and Twitter at theater_podcast. Leave a rating and a review of both this podcast and the 54 Below podcast. This has been edited by Well-Rounded Hoodlum Productions. And Megan Hilty, thank you most of all. This has been so much fun.
Thank you. This has been delightful.
You've been listening to the Fine Science 54 Below podcast, part of the Broadway Podcast Network. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.